Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, May 6th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, we've got Money and Markets and Ask Catherine, then an interview with John Williams of Shadow Stats for a look at the real economic data. I've wanted to have John on for a long time, and I couldn't be more pleased. Tonight, no movie. The latest in the financial markets is wilder and certainly more entertaining than fiction. And I wanted to make sure we had all the time we wanted for our conversation with John. Our theme tonight is moving forward. I've had one too many people tell me this week that they think things are hopeless, which they're not. But we are at war, and the primary goal of the people trying to steal from us is to persuade us that it is hopeless. It's a lot easier to take what's yours if you're feeling that way. Now, I'm not trying to be one of those what I call the post-fraud cheerleaders who, after you've been harvested, try and get you encouraged to work hard and grow another crop so it can be harvested again. At the same time, though, power comes from two places, force, which I believe doesn't last, and the other is taking responsibility, which if enough people do, it attracts power and resources. The world is changing, and the changes are going to become more dramatic, and certainly this year, it's not going to be next year, it's going to be this year. But we move forward because that's the direction that serves us and the wider community best. And there are real solutions to our problem, and we're going to find them if we move forward in a way that takes responsibility. So it's not hopeless. Let's move forward. Well, the market closed down today. I was on the phone with a reporter from Bloomberg who stopped mid-sentence and said, "Do you realize the market's down almost 1,000 points? Of course, it came back up and closed down. The Dow closed down $347.80. This is being explained away by an incorrect order entry by a Citigroup floor trader on a Procter & Gamble stock. And my quote, if you go to the top of the blog, is, "Heard of the loan assassin or the loan trader or the loan computer glitch? Get ready for the loan typo." Now, what does it say about the world's largest global stock market if it can lose 10% from one typo? Now, I doubt that's true, but if it is, there's something seriously wrong with this whole system. Even if it's not true, there's something else seriously wrong with the whole system. Whatever happened, somebody made a whole lot of money, whether on short sales or picking up Procter & Gamble stock and a lot of other stocks at cheap prices. The SEC and CFTC, Commodity Future Trade Commission, have indicated they're reviewing, quote, unusual trading activity after Wall Street plunge. That's an understatement. But there are plenty of legitimate concerns in the market. Let's assume that say the rumors are true, that there were big redemptions in some of the hedge funds because of the European situation, and it tripped off the automatic programming. It still shows a market that's very insecure, and so let's look at what we're insecure about. There's a lot of new news that would shake a variety of different people up for different reasons. We had the Senate just recently cut a deal indicating that its amendment to the Dodd bill, a deal on breaking up the too-big-to-fail houses rather than require a bailout. So enormous new controls by Washington, political controls of financial houses. We have the FCC proposing greater controls centrally of the Internet. It's enough to shake a lot of people. And then, of course, we have the sovereign bond problems in Greece. Now, the Greek situation is sufficiently small that the notion that it could bring the financial market to its knees is, of course, ridiculous. At the same time, the sovereign debt crisis is a real issue, and it's one that's causing a spiral down in productivity. The Greek bailout is not a bailout of Greece. It's a bailout of the big banks that financed a pump and dump of Greece, along with a lot of other places. I mean, this all started, if you remember, back in 1995 with, quote-unquote, Mexican bailout. Somebody once said that the Mexican bailout went from the Treasury over to, or really at the Treasury accounts at J.P. Morgan Chase to the bank accounts of the other big bank accounts at J.P. Morgan Chase and never left Wall Street and certainly never got to Mexico. And we're looking at the same kind of thing here with the indication that, a lot of the big European banks, including the French banks, were taken out. One of the issues here is that the Greek people are being are being pretty clear they don't want to be liable for pump and dump creditors. So we're coming down to a situation of who's going to get rolled here. Is it going to be the pump and dump creditors, or is it going to be labor? And for 15, 20 years, it's been labor, and labor's indicating they don't like that. Now, they also don't like, it's not just a matter of who gets what, it's a matter of what the new rules are, like limitations on cash, and sort of other new world order controls. And in one sense, the Greeks are, if anything, are fighting for all of us. Because what you're really looking at is an economic hit on Greece. But the signal to the sovereign bond market is now that we've printed far more currency and debt than we can collateralize or pay back, it's a game of musical chairs as to who's going to, whose chair is going to get pulled and what bondholder is not going to get paid. Now, part of the difficulty in Europe is the European Union does not have taxing power or weapons the way the United States does. You see many commentators this week saying, well, the U.S.'s debt problem is worse than Europe. Yes, Europe is much more fundamentally strong economically at this point than the U.S., but if you look at the organization, the U.S. government has more powers and is clearly voting itself a lot more powers as we speak. But we're going to continue to see a game of musical chairs in the currency and bond markets and the derivatives that are piled on top vis-a-vis what's going on in tangibles and real-world values. And to defend the bond market or the derivatives market, that puts equity markets at risk. So this has just begun. I continue to predict that we're going to slow burn through the summer. But the challenge is we've got covert wars escalating. There are numerous events going on that are described as either accidents or Mother Nature. I'm skeptical as to really how many of them are Mother Nature. There are plenty of covert actions going on. But it gives you a sense that as the game of musical chairs escalates, that the covert tensions are getting worse and worse, and of course that can break out in a war, because the solution to, the game of musical chairs is to have wars. When I worked in the Bush administration, once had an appointee turn to me and he said, this kind of politics is crazy. It's like everybody's in a rubber lifeboat on the ocean going at each other with razor blades. Don't they know we're gonna mess up the whole situation? And whatever the explanation of what happened in the oil spill in the Gulf, it's a little bit like that rubber lifeboat with razor blades. The Gulf oil spill is something I'm not going to talk a lot about today, but it could turn very, very serious. I mean, it's very serious now. It could turn even more serious. Managing this kind of situation through an election season, because remember, this summer we're coming into Obama's first midterm election for Congress, and there's a lot of tension around this. So really, prayers for the engineers who are being called on to fix it. Let's just hope they succeed, because if they don't, we could be in for something more horrific than war. What this means to you and me is the systemic risk is going up. The fundamental lawlessness in the system is rising. There's going to be increased price volatility. It's the grinding of the gears I talked about in the year-end wrap-up. If you haven't listened to Position Your Assets for Growth in Uncertain Time, it's a good overview of what we all need to do in our lives to, stay grounded, stick to the basics, stick to people you know and trust and things you understand. We're coming into a much more elemental time. We're also reaching a tipping point in where the financial system is going. There are lots of clues that we're moving to a global currency. There was a very important trial balloon by Bill Clinton. You can see it up on the blog. It's a video of him discussing the problems since we went off the gold standard and basically intimating the idea of moving to a metacurrency through the SDR system. And, of course, the implication is, in one sense, a kind of gold standard behind it. Now, what does this mean? It means, despite how much gold was up today, we really are just at the beginning of a long process of reconciling tangibles to all the fiat currency and other funny paper, whether it's sovereign bonds or derivatives on top of them or mortgage securities that have been issued. And that process has a long way to go. One of the things Clinton said that has always been true, I've said it for many years, and it's going to be important spin that is part of this reevaluation of tangibles vis-a-vis financial paper, is that the problem with the Goldman deal was that it wasn't about real things. It added no value. Speaking about the mortgage deal that is part of the SEC's complaint against Goldman Sachs and for which Goldman is also being investigated by the Department of Justice. It was called an abacus. It was a CDO deal. And what he said was the deal served no purpose in the real economy, and the problem is we've developed a financial system which is destructive of the real economy, and so we need to get back to a system which is supportive of the real economy. Now, all of that is true. You know, it's always funny to hear Bill Clinton, who led the hot money game, if anything, for the, you know, when he was president and has encouraged it since and certainly been the beneficiary of it. But it's absolutely true, and it's a very important signal of where this is going. Two more little things, but very important signals. Swiss National Bank called a meeting in Zurich. You can read about it on the blog with the IMF, and my prediction is there is a serious discussion coming of the SDR system through the IMF that can serve as sort of a meta-global currency. We have Larry Kudlow today, very much a mainstream commentator, announcing that gold is the new reserve currency. Now, in the game of musical chairs, one of the people expected to lose his seat at the table is Lloyd Blankfein, chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs. I've been following the Goldman Sachs story very, very closely, and there's a series of commentaries up on the blog. And if you're interested, I would really recommend you read it. One was, the first was Goldman Whack-A-Mole, which has gotten tremendous readership on the Internet, and followed by Pricing Goldman Allegations, and then last night I published Thumbing Down Blankfein in response to a series of articles in the Wall Street Journal suggesting that Blankfein's days were numbered. What you're watching is the team of people who engineered the strong dollar policy really be disgraced and pushed out, and it's a sign that we're moving on to into the new. Interestingly enough, Clinton, who was the leader as the president of that strong dollar policy, as I mentioned last time, we have him saying in testimony, "I was a mistake to listen to Summers and Rubin." So he's cutting his ties and leaving the Goldman crowd to struggle in disgrace for all of this, for really engineering a brilliant financial scheme to finance the coup d'etat. We have the Fed continuing to fight the Bloomberg case. It looks like they're going to go all the way to the Supreme Court. That's a very interesting struggle. Solari published another special report this week. It's called GLD and SLV, or Disclosure in the Precious Metals Puzzle Palace, about the two precious metals ETFs. It's gotten tremendous postage. It's article of the day at 24-hour gold on Wednesday. Key precious metals article and editor's pick at Financial Sense on the Gadawire Scoop Wire. It was up at Zero Hedge Top on Wednesday morning, on and on. What we're beginning to see is the accumulated postings in the what's now called the financial blogosphere are really competing head on in terms of hits and numbers with the traditional mainstream media. Anyway, it's a very serious piece and designed to make it clear that a lot of that these two particular ETFs are not a way to buy gold and silver. They're really, if anything, from a credit standpoint, it's literally, as far as I'm concerned, an unsecured bank deposit that's priced in gold and silver. So it makes for a liquid trading vehicle in a slow burn situation, but in the worst case, you know, who knows what you've got there. And there are very serious conflicts of interest. J.P. Morgan Chase, who's the custodian on SLV, has the biggest short position in the market. Lots of rumors floating around this week about their short positions and the possibility of a Department of Justice inquiry into them. Who knows what's true, but it shows you that there's this problem that Wall Street has that has come out in the Goldman case of being on a different side than your client and having very deep and profound conflicts of interest is coming out. So there's going to be more of that. So going forward, lots of opportunities, but it's going to be in the real economy. What Clinton is saying is, okay, now time to switch. we've pulled out all the money, so we have to go back to work. The shift to Asia continues. I want to talk about it more, particularly next week in precious metals. It's very important. Another very big important article, Peggy Noonan's new editorial, The Big Alienation is Serious, talking about the real frustration with government and the inability of government to keep the financial house in order or the physical security house in order. Very dirty games going on around immigration and an effort to get the national ID card that's really putting people along the border at risk. It's a great editorial and talks, you know, gives an underscore to my concern that this is going to be a very long hot summer as congressmen come home and face their constituencies. So please budget some time in your schedule this summer to handle the unexpected, because it's definitely going to be here. Our hero this week, John Doolin, a name you probably have never heard, the police chief in Whiteville, Tennessee, down the road from me, about 10 miles in Hardeman County, ran for sheriff in the Democratic primary in Hardeman County. A lot of my neighbors gathered to support him. We were told we could never win. And he did win the Democratic primary this week. So I asked the question of many of you in a wonderful Solari report with Richard Mack, who's your sheriff? Well, my sheriff is going to be, after the election round here, the Democratic primary is the election, but after the final election, my sheriff's going to be John Doolin, and I'm pretty happy about that. Okay, Ask Catherine. We had more great questions. Someone had asked a question about aren't they killing the goose that laid the golden egg, and came back with another one saying yes, but I had said, you know, we don't, the powers that be don't need the American consumer to keep the economy going. We're being rebalanced, as the economist would said. And they said, what kind of world do you want? Will it all look like Detroit? And what I would suggest is you watch the Aaron Russo video that I've posted on the blog about, just do a search on the blog for Aaron Russo on his conversation with one of the Rockefellers, or again, the Sir James Goldsmith interview with Charlie Rose in 1994, which is up on the blog. These, you know, what they describe is a vision of a world where there's a much smaller population and the leadership have used digital technology to have complete control. It's a very, very black vision, but there it is, and it is now. I don't think it's going to happen, but I think we're going to have to go through a lot of Sturm und Drang before that vision fails. And remember, the key thing to that vision failing is for people to put forward a vision which is far more attractive and inspires a lot more transparency in markets and collaboration, and something which is much more environmentally effective and healing. Because, you know, we're going to have to get to an environmentally sensible place with a large population. Obviously, moving to a smaller population could do it, but that's not, certainly wouldn't be my first choice. Another comment, the CCX, which is the climate exchange, smells fishy, according to Glenn Beck. Actually, Glenn Beck, who I sometimes just want to did a marvelous job of describing just how fishy it is. In fact, he was kind, so I posted some of the videos up on the blog. You can catch them if you keep clicking down, and they're quite funny. So another question, maybe this would be worth talking about in the Solari report. I wondered why the market dropped as much as it did without the exchange having halted trading. Today he's talking about the near 1,000-point plunge today. Then I learned that the trigger was 10%. It seemed that the market recovered abruptly before momentum could build to the 10%. Did the plunge protection team intervene? It seemed like a strange recovery. Someone used the word violent. It's like someone showed their hand. On the flip side, could it be that there was some sort of message being sent in what happened today? Just strange. I would say violent and strange are good words. If you look at what happened to Bear Stearns and where Bear Stearns went down, you had what's called a bear raid, where a group of people get together and drive the stock down. You know, we don't begin to have the facts here, but whatever happened was quite strange, and I'm almost beginning to wonder, bear raid on the New York Stock Exchange, it certainly looked like that. Finally, what is secure email? Following Catherine Albrecht's wonderful interview about spy chips last month, a number of people have asked the question, well, what email should I use? In one sense, there is no such thing as secure email. In another, the best thing you can use is your own server and use PGP encryption or another excellent encryption system if you know of it. But it would be good to know what of the sort of public systems are the most relatively safe. And remember, it is relative, and we're researching that. I don't have an answer yet, but I intend to. Okay, so that's it for Ask Catherine. And now it is my pleasure to introduce to you John Williams of Shadow Stats. Are you with us, John? He's got to star six. Did you hit pound six? You need to hit star six. John?
Yes, hi. Hello, Catherine. How are you?
Hi. It's wonderful to have you with us. Let me just give an introduction. John, it is so unnerving if you are a business person or an investment person and you're trying to follow the economy and you don't have good statistics. And one of the things we've seen over the last, well, for a while now, is we've seen a real deterioration in the quality of federal government statistics. Many businesses have traditionally depended on government statistics for a wide range of functions. And as the government statistics became more and more political, you know, first in the Bush administration, then the Clinton administration, then the next Bush administration, it took me, it was a couple of years ago that I discovered John Williams of Shadow Stats. And John has been an economist for many years, and literally as the government statistics began deteriorating, started to adjust them to help his clients, you know, to come up with reliable statistics on what has been going on in the economy and the markets. And it has reached the point now where among many investment people and many financial people, we refer to Shadow Stats the way we used to refer to, you know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics or some other form of credible government statistics. So John and Shadow Stats have become the go-to guy in the whole world of what's really going on in the economy. So John, maybe if we could start, if you could describe your history of how you became the go-to guy on the real deal on economic data.
Well, I believe it or not, the manipulations go back before my active business career. I became a consulting economist in the early 1980s and found early on that there were some problems that were driving some of my clients' models literally off the wall. They were not working. One was a commercial airline manufacturer who used revenue passenger miles as a key marketing tool, very heavily dependent on what was then referred to as the gross national product, the GNP. Turned out there were major trade distortions in the trade deficit, which affected the GNP. I corrected those. The model worked again. But as time went on, those numbers fell apart. And let me just back up a little bit. Modern economic reporting came into being basically post-World War II. Before World War II, you had a crude industrial production series that the Fed put out. There was a CPI measure, but most people relied on the stock market as an indication of how business was. Stocks were up generally, good times. Stocks were down, not so good times. The employment numbers, as we know them, were all post-World War II. Retail sales, durable goods orders, all the numbers that the markets tend to follow today started in the late 40s, early 50s. It took the government administrations almost a decade to really start playing games with the numbers. During the Kennedy administration, the concept of a discouraged worker was introduced. These are people who meet all the qualifications of being unemployed, except they haven't looked for work recently because there are no jobs to be had. in terms of...
So they stopped being unemployed statistically.
They were still counted, but they weren't counted as part of the main unemployment number.
Right.
The government now publishes, and it's been through changes, six levels of unemployment. U3 is the headline number that we'll see tomorrow morning. U6 is their broadest measure. U3's been running around 9.7%. U6 has been roughly 7 percentage points higher. And that includes a measure of discouraged workers. But during the Clinton administration, the concept of discouraged worker was changed from just being someone who hadn't looked for work in a while to someone who hadn't looked for a work or had looked for work in the last year. If it had been more than a year since they'd looked for work, they were no longer counted. And that knocked a significant number off the long-term discouraged workers. I've added that back in, and when you talk about my alternative measures, I end up showing something that's 5 percentage points higher than the U6 measure as being close to what people would think unemployment is. And
right.
As you go over time, Lyndon Johnson probably was the first great manipulator of the data. He would look at the GNP number, and if he didn't like it, he'd send it back to the Commerce Department, and he'd keep sending it back until they got it right. Jumping ahead to more recent administrations, and almost every administration has its own story. If you look at the first Bush administration, George Bush was in a recession in his reelection bid against Bill Clinton. And a senior Commerce Department official went to a senior computer industry executive, said, "Hey, we need to get George reelected. Let's boost the reporting of computer sales to the Bureau of Economic Analysis," which was the entity that prepared the, what was that then, I think, the GDP number, gross domestic product, purportedly the broadest measure of economic activity. And the computer sales were boosted. The recession ended. George Bush looked like he's out of touch with reality, saying that the economy was better, but those numbers were actually manipulated from the outside. I knew some of the people involved in it, and I confirmed it a couple of years later with people at the Bureau of Economic Analysis. Then you jump ahead to the Bill Clinton administration. He was even better, I should not personalize it, I'd say his administration was as creative as Lyndon Johnson's. There were things such as the poverty report. Poverty report is surveyed every year on the March unemployment report. And so what they did as Mr. Clinton was coming up for reelection was they reduced the number of households being surveyed. They'd go out and survey 60,000 households a month. They cut it back to 50,000, but the households they cut were inner city. And, I called the Bureau of Labor Statistics and said, "Well, you know, that's going to bias your numbers." They said, "Oh, no problem. We can model it. We can account for the differential." Well, sure enough, the unemployment levels among the black population dropped. The poverty rate improved for the first time in some number of years, just in time for Mr. Clinton's reelection bid. And there were so help me, at the end of the Clinton administration, they increased the survey base again in time to boost unemployment for George Bush the second. And that was done under the cover of changes that were put through Congress for specific purposes. There are basically two types of manipulation here. One is the event-driven manipulation, like the event with George Bush's people spiking the GDP before the election. The other is changing methodologies in the reporting of key statistics, such as the unemployment rate or payroll employment, the GDP, the CPI. And the changing of the methodologies almost always has moved as I put a bias into the numbers, it's politically favorable, giving you stronger numbers for the economy, weaker numbers on the inflation front. And
haven't we reached a tipping point where people just don't believe the numbers anymore?
Well, that's very true. And in fact, there was a I found that to be the case for some time. If you go back again to the Clinton administration, there was a survey conducted by the Washington Post and the Kaiser Foundation. They went out and surveyed the American people. What's the unemployment rate? What's inflation? What's the GDP growth? And the summary of the article, the conclusion was, boy, are the American people stupid, because they showed unemployment to be much higher and inflation to be much higher and economic growth to be much weaker than was being reported. But I'll contend that the American people had a much better handle in terms of what was happening to the areas that directly affect their lives than what the government was reporting. The problem
was
the government.
That's what I've always found.
I'm sorry?
That's what I've always found, is the population is remarkably intelligent about the basic, you know, issues of what's really going on.
Well, very, very, very much so. I mean, if I ask you, or if I ask someone at random whether or not he or she is unemployed, they're going to come back with an answer fairly quickly. They know whether or not they're unemployed. Now, if you added up all the people who thought they were unemployed, you'd come up with a higher number than the government has.
Right.
And I'm not saying the government's number is wrong, because it is as it's defined. But the way the average person looks at it, it's short. So that instead of being at 9.7%, it's over 20%. If you look at inflation, and this is a very important topic.
Yes, very. I'm going to ask you, in fact, about your big hyperinflation report, but keep going on inflation.
Okay. Well, the concept with inflation, when it was first became popularly used in the auto union contracts as a cost of living adjustment, the idea was that the CPI was measuring the cost of living that was inherent in maintaining a constant standard of living. I mean, you wanted to be at least able to
culture
live next year the
same
way you did the year before.
Right.
And so what they do is, using in very simplistic terms, they'd take a pound of beef, they'd take a gallon of gas, a loaf of bread, they price them out in 1 year, then they price those same goods out the next year, and whatever the price differential was, that would be the rate of inflation. Well, in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, Alan Greenspan and Michael Boskin, who was then the head of the Council of Economic Advisors for the first President Bush, started talking about how the CPI really overstates inflation. And you'll still hear this in the academic community today. Bernanke will still talk about it. And you ask them why. They say, well, if steak gets too expensive, people will start buying hamburger. And if they buy hamburger, then their cost of living is lower. Well, that may be true, but it's not consistent with the original concept of the CPI,
right,
which is a constant standard of living. If you look at the changes made here, and let me just make one other example as to how the numbers diverge from common experience. You take gasoline, where a new additive has been mandated by the government for environmental purposes. It adds 10 cents a gallon to the cost of gasoline. This is an actual example. Because air quality was to be improved, the Bureau of Labor Statistics deemed that to be a quality improvement and didn't increase the CPI by the cost of that 10 cents per gallon. But the average person who has to fill his or her tank of gasoline to get to work looks at how much is coming out of their pocket. That they're not thinking, gee, I'm spending 10 cents a gallon here to have better air. They're thinking about making ends meet.
Right.
And in terms of maintaining a constant standard of living, that's what they're concerned about, buying gas, flying from New York to Chicago, how much does that cost me? Buying a computer, How much does it cost me to buy a computer? The fact that you've got all sorts of additional features on it now is not necessarily a plus for individuals. But all these things get adjusted in the CPI. A computer today, I have two computers sitting on my desk. One I bought 10 years ago for $1,000. And based on the way the CPI has been adjusted for the quality improvements in computers, and indeed there have been quality improvements, I should be able to buy that same unit for $50 today.
Mm-hmm.
Can't do it. The replacement model, which I don't like as much as the first one, still cost me $1,000.
Right.
Yet computers are such a big part of the economy, it's had a major impact in reducing the reported rate of inflation. The changes that were made to reduce the reported rate of inflation were done so very openly. There were congressional hearings on it, pushed through Congress. A lot of academics jumped on the bandwagon and say, yep, that's right, people buy hamburgers, lower cost of living. The purpose of that was to reduce the annual cost of living adjustments to Social Security. It was a way to help contain the deficit without having anyone in Congress having to vote against Social Security. The net effect is Social Security checks would be about double what they are today.
Right.
They've not made all those changes.
So the purchasing power on somebody on Social Security is diminishing significantly.
It is, and they know it.
Right.
They don't need me to tell them that they're not keeping up with inflation. The average family's not keeping up with inflation, and this is a very important factor in terms of where the economy is now, why we're not going to have a near-term recovery, and in fact, one reason that we're going into what I'm referring to as a hyperinflation.
Now, one of the things, Sean, one of the techniques they use is just canceling a series, because one of the numbers that all of us look to was M3 money supply,
mm-hmm.
and the Fed literally just canceled it.
That's right.
You're tracking M3. There's a variety of people trying to track M3. That's a valuable statistic.
Well, I've always found it such. The Fed canceled its publication of M3, stating first that it didn't add any information beyond what they had for M2, and second, that it was too expensive to track it.
Yeah, when I was in the government, that was always our excuse. We couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
So we could afford $12 trillion in bailouts, but we couldn't afford to keep the economists calculating M3.
Right. The funny thing is they still calculate most of the components. They just don't put them together. I take their components, I model a couple of small ones, put them together, and I still track M3. The reason I do so is that the broader the measure of the money supply, usually the better indicator it is of what's happening to systemic liquidity, which is important eventually to inflation and also in terms of economic activity. And what we're seeing right now, and indeed, as you mentioned, I still track M3, adjusted for inflation. In fact, not adjusted for inflation. M3 is contracting year over year. It's contracting in a manner not seen since the Great Depression, before inflation adjustment. And after inflation adjustment, it's the worst downturn year over year seen since World War II.
So technically we're really in a deflation in terms
it sounds like a deflation, but it really isn't. I mean,
the money supply isn't shrinking?
The money supply, as it's reported by the Fed,
mm-hmm.
and look at, is shrinking. And if you define it strictly by the domestic money supply, that would be deflation. When I talk inflation or deflation, I'm talking about the annual change in consumer goods and services.
Right. So price inflation.
Price inflation.
Right.
And in terms of the economic theory is wonderful. But it rarely has use in the real world. I mean, if you want to come up with a hard number on something or make a good decision on something, if you had a country such as Zimbabwe where the monetary system's enclosed, there what happens to the money supply gets reflected in the inflation fairly quickly. In the U.S., with the dollar's global reserve status, you also have to take into account not only the money supply that's indicated by the Fed as maybe take the narrowest measure, M1, which is cash basically plus the variety of checking accounts, M2, which is M1 plus small savings accounts, personal mutual funds, and M3, which takes you into the large time deposits, institutional money funds, Eurodollar holdings, and repos, non-bank repos that the banks hold, or reverse repos. But the point is that the you also have to look at the global scope of the dollar, and where the total M3 is running maybe $14 trillion. There's also about $7 trillion of liquid cash or near cash outside the U.S. system, and as long as the foreign investors are willing to hold that, it doesn't affect the domestic economy and the money supply. But if you see a shift there, people all of a sudden don't want to hold the dollar. You have major problems from an inflation standpoint, because those dollars need to be absorbed. It becomes very inflationary. The dollar gets weaker. We've seen over the last year, although this has been up and down, we haven't had a real panic decline in the dollar. As the dollar weakens, oil prices rise.
Right.
Now, it's not that we're seeing strong demand for oil. It's just that oil is denominated in dollars. And if the dollar drops, let's say, against the yen, that means that the Japanese purchasers of oil are getting a discount in yen terms. And the markets tend to balance that out, and what you see is upside pressure on oil prices in dollar terms. Oil is probably the single most, it is the most important commodity in terms of U.S. price inflation. It not only reflects energy costs, but anything that has to be transported in terms of goods or people. It's at the base of many products, chemicals, pharmaceuticals, fertilizers, plastics. We're beginning to see some passage into the system of the broader impact of the recent rise in oil prices. The literal deflation that we did have, and we did have some deflation this last year, where the year-over-year change in the consumer prices, as reported by the government, dropped about 2%. That's somewhat parallel to what happened back in the 50s. It was not not the big deflation that you had back in the Great Depression. And Mr. Bernanke was trying to avoid a Great Depression-type deflation. And if you measured the CPI the way it was back in the 1950s, we didn't have a formal deflation there. It was shallow, but it was relatively short.
You calculated was what employment, if unemployment was the same as it was in the Great Depression, what would it be today? And I think, we're at 22%.
Sam, I've got it around 22%. It's that order of magnitude.
Mm-hmm.
The government did not measure unemployment back during the Great Depression. It estimated after the fact what it hit at its worst, which would have been 1932 or 1933. And the estimate was 25%, but we're not close to the Great Depression yet. We're still probably the worst seen in the 1973-75 recession. Where things are different is that in the Great Depression, that unemployment rate also included farm workers, and at that time, 27% of the population worked on farms.
Right.
Today, that's less than 2%. And if you look at the non-farm unemployment rate back then, that was closer to 35%. And I think that's probably a fair comparison with today's number.
So if you put the non-farm workers at 35%, then today it's 22%.
Right.
Okay. So we got quite a ways to go before we hit the Great Depression.
In terms of unemployment, the thing is that the numbers as reported show the longest and the deepest downturn since the Great Depression.
Right.
And in fact, the there's no question in terms of the length part of it. There was a deeper downturn in between, and that was the production shutdown at the end of World War II.
Uh-huh.
But that's not generally viewed as a regular business cycle.
Right.
It's so shy of that.
So,
I mean,
hyperinflation, you strongly feel that we are moving into a hyperinflationary period, and you wrote a great piece at the beginning of the year on that and have talked about it since then. And I would appreciate your sort of describing what hyperinflation is, how it's happened in other places, and what you think could happen here.
Well, in terms of hyperinflation, basically the currency becomes worthless in terms of its purchasing power. My very crude definition, because there are all sorts of definitions out there, whether it's 1,000% or 1,000,000%. Basically, if the largest denomination bill becomes worth more as, this is before hyperinflation, becomes worth more as a toilet tissue than as currency, you have a hyperinflation. And that happened in the Weimar Republic in the early 20s. And the most recent extreme case was Zimbabwe.
I have one of those Zimbabwe million-dollar bills.
Well, they actually get up to 100 trillion, and they kept lopping off the zeros.
Yeah.
And if you left all the zeros on and put a pile of bills to equal what it used to be worth, it would stretch from here to the Andromeda Galaxy. There are not enough trees to print it. I mean, you're talking literally light years high. Yet the Zimbabwe economy continued to function. The reason it did was it had a black market in U.S. dollars that enabled the people to have something of a normal economic existence. We don't have a backup. And let me tell you why I think we're going into hyperinflation here. I mean, more like the German kind, where they had gold was something of a backup there, and there were other currencies. We've never seen this with a world's reserve currency.
Right.
But one of the numbers that gets terribly distorted is the federal budget deficit. And after 30 years of the Congress and the various administrations working with what used to be the Big Ten accounting firms and whatever it is now, early in this decade started publishing financial statements on the government that use generally accepted accounting principles, GAAP accounting, the way most large corporations do. The government reports its deficit and still reports its deficit for most purposes is on a cash basis, cash in, cash out, and the money that's come in the way of Social Security taxes, which has been in surplus until this year. That surplus was just added to the general fund and was used to reduce the reported cash deficit. That was a gimmick introduced by Lyndon Johnson. But instead of something in the $450 billion range in 2008 and the $1.4 trillion that we saw in 2009, on a GAAP basis, the deficit's running in the $4 to $5 trillion range, not billion, trillion. And that includes the net present value, the year-to-year change in the net present value of the unfunded liabilities in Social Security and Medicare. Net present value being the amount of cash you need in hand today to cover those expenses in the future. $4 to $5 trillion a year, which is what the situation's deteriorating by each year now. I mean, we're seeing total debt and obligations of the government up over $70 trillion. Again, that's net present value. That's basically five times the GDP level. It's nothing that can ever be paid off in a normal fashion. If the government wanted to balance the numbers in 1 year, just in terms of the annual numbers, and taxed 100% of income and corporate profit, took 100% of income profit, nobody had anything left after taxes, they'd still be in deficit.
Right.
If the government cut every penny of government spending except for Social Security and Medicare, it would still be in deficit.
Right.
The problem is that Social Security and Medicare have to be slashed severely if the government has a chance of wants to have a chance of surviving as a financial entity. There's no political will to do so. What's going to happen here is I see it, and there's nothing happening in Washington right now to change my mind on it. they're going to be, as they need the money, they're just going to be printing it. And over time, that debases the currency gives you the hyperinflation. This was all in place before the current financial crisis. Crisis breaks, we start spending an awful lot of money, the rest of the world starts moaning and groaning about the size of the federal deficit, about the funding needs of the U.S. Treasury. And so without that blowing apart, I think we'll have a hyperinflation within the next 5 years. But right now we have a circumstance where that contraction in the money supply is signaling a downturn in the economy. Most people are looking for the economy to grow this year. The underlying assumptions for the federal deficit are all for economic growth this year. The deficit's going to blow apart. The funding needs are going to explode. You're going to see a mounting rebellion by foreign investors, dumping of the dollar. And as that happens, that's at high risk of pushing us into a hyperinflation, at least the early stages of it, within the next year.
Right. Now, I'm a great believer that we have the wherewithal to force them to hold the paper. The problem is it takes more and more force. So you're looking at a situation where you have creditors, you have the military budget, and then you have the Social Security, Medicare needs. And so, you know, whether it's money, labor, or military, they all can't keep getting the amount of money they're getting. Something has to give.
Right.
And that's the political dynamite. How much have consumer prices gone up this year so far?
Officially,
what I'm seeing at the grocery store is phenomenal increases.
Sorry?
What I'm seeing at the grocery store is just phenomenal increases.
Year over year, it's about a little over 2%, according to the government.
Okay.
And I would estimate it's somewhere between 5 and 9%, depending upon the basis you want to look at it. The difference between my numbers and the government's basically is what's been lost in maintaining a constant standard of living.
Right. Right. Well, John, we had a couple of questions from subscribers that I wanted to ask you. And, in fact, I put up a great let me just ask you. I know this is hard for you two to imagine, but if you only owned a few thousand in silver and a house and cars free and clear, would you take a home equity loan out and buy a silver coin? Does Sean think it would be better to buy it in the U.S. and move it out, like, with gold money? So.
Oh, boy. That's
a tough one.
It's a tough one because I wouldn't normally suggest that. I mean, when you have inflation, that's supposed to be the debtor's friend. But hyperinflation here, and people are welcome to go to my site and read the hyperinflation report, which goes into greater detail. I just see that as leading to extraordinary financial pain, possible, very likely social and political upheaval, hopefully nonviolent, but you can never tell how something like that's going to go. And if things get crazy enough, you don't know how the government's going to respond. I mean, you look at what's happened in the last year. The government's been intervening in mortgages. There's nothing to prevent them from going the other way. Things get tough. You lose a job. You need to be able to maintain your debt payments during this period of time till things get to the point that you can pay them off for a penny. And if you don't, you lose everything that you have. It's
right.
It's not a stable, good situation.
I think this is a good time to be debt free. And I think trying to run arbitrages is a dangerous business.
Yeah, absolutely.
On holding in the U.S. or elsewhere, we have generally on the Solari Report encouraged people to not have everything in one place but in different places. But I do like the idea of having it physical control and having it be the beauty of precious metals is they're portable.
Right.
you
I
can
fully,
put them in your pocket and walk away.
I would have I'd have some gold, some silver. I'd look to also have some dollars in foreign currency and some assets outside the, not only outside the dollar but outside the United States. That's just prudent.
Okay, next question. How high do you see gold and silver going? Also, do you think the dollar will collapse or will it just be in a third world status forever? How are you personally preparing, if I may ask?
The dollar, I look for the dollar to absolutely collapse, which means what you see in silver and gold prices ultimately is unlimited on the upside in terms of dollars. The thing is that when this starts to go, let's say gold's at $10,000 an ounce, you say, oh boy, I'm going to sell out and make a profit. You're not making a profit. I mean, it might, there might be some relative profit, but generally what you're seeing here is the gold acts as a store of wealth. It's preserving your purchasing power. So that when $10,000, you still have the same purchasing power of the dollars that went into it. The problem
minus
is
the capital gains.
Huh? Well,
minus the capital gains.
I don't think the government's going to be collecting taxes much when this breaks, because I mean, you're going to get paid more
right.
per penny overnight. In Germany, you could go into a restaurant to order the most expensive bottle of wine, and the next morning that bottle be worth more as scrap glass than it was filled with expensive wine the night before. That's
right.
how rapidly the prices change. And they can't do anything with taxes on that basis. You see a cessation
right.
of normal business.
Although, if they succeed, let's say the IMF and the world central banks put together sort of a meta FDR system against the gold standard,
mm-hmm.
another scenario I think we could see is a radical revaluation overnight. So you go to bed and gold's at 1,200, and you wake up the next day and it's at 5,000.
They can do that, but it's not going to work unless at the same time, and if they do this, they don't have to go to the gold standard. They have to cure the fiscal problems.
Right.
If they don't cure the fiscal problems, then you're just going to see ongoing devaluation against gold.
Right.
They have to solve the fiscal problems. Without that, it doesn't work. You're not going to have a global currency. You're not going to have any kind of a gold standard that will survive. I do think that as this blows apart, I don't see any way of avoiding the hyperinflation so that as the dollar does become worthless, other currencies will likely kick in as reserve currencies. But you're going to have a recasting of the global currency system. I don't know how that'll go, any number of ways it can go, but I would suspect that when that is done, that in order to gain public acceptance, there's going to be some tie to gold in it.
In answering the question, what you are personally preparing to do?
Let me
jump in first. I would say you're doing the most important thing, which is creating a business which can be invaluable to people in this environment, because you're basically providing the statistics that people need to function. So I would say one of the most important things you're doing to prepare is you've created a business that's useful to people in the new environment.
Well, that is a big plus. It gives you ongoing income. I don't know what kind of ongoing income I'm going to have here. I'll be asking people for gold coins for subscriptions. But I practice what I preach. I look to own physical gold, silver, look to have some money outside the dollar. And I do have... there's one other area here. Again, people just have to use common sense. If you're going to see a hyperinflation and you see a disruption to the normal food supply chain, for example, you can't get food at grocery stores, you're going to have very difficult times in the streets, particularly around the urban centers. So for people who maybe have exposure there, I mean, if you're growing your own food, that's fine, but if you're... I mean, goodness, right now I live out in just outside of San Francisco on the Hayward Fault. People in that area generally keep a store of food to last them for a little while in the event of a big earthquake. This is like a major natural disaster, although in many ways a lot worse than it's man-made. But it's you need to look to hold. Basic commodities that you can live off of. You can't count on a barter system starting up right away. That'll take a little while to kick in. So enough food to live on for a couple of months, canned foods, dried foods, whatever, then also having some goods for barter. And, again, it all depends on what a person's particular tastes are. I know someone... from Argentina told me that they had found that small change in a hyperinflation ideal thing was an airline bottle of scotch. good quality scotch.
Dimitri was said in Russia, it was bottles of vodka.
Well, use something that you otherwise would consume if I'm completely nuts here.
We have to close, John. So I just wanted to remind everyone, you have subscribers, and you're putting out regular.
Amazingly enough, I do. A couple of them.
I'm a very satisfied subscriber, so we can sign up at your website. You also do consultations?
I do, what I'd suggest for anyone who wants to get more information on this, just go to my website, which is shadowstats.com. There's a lot of information available to the public, including the most recent hyperinflation report. That gives you the general story as to why it's going to happen and some ways that you can protect yourself. We can't cover it all in half an hour on the radio, unfortunately.
Right.
And there are primer series on the different government statistics as to where there are problems there. You can get my alternative measures of the different series. And, of course, if anyone's interested in subscribing to the current commentaries, we're always happy to have new subscribers. But there's a lot of information there for the general
John public. Williams, we are very happy to have a reliable source of statistics.
Well, so you
take care of yourself, because we're going to need you.
Thank you for your kind comments, and thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, coming up next week, May 13th, Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. We got plenty to talk about. May 20th, I've invited Clifford Carnicom. We're going to be talking more on chemtrails, particularly how do we, if the opportunity, if problem equals opportunity, how do we get an integration of people like Clifford into the conversation about building local economies and fresh food and other solutions which have been really resistant to going and integrating the information that's sort of outside the boundaries of the matrix, but information we need to really get to honest solutions and honest maps of what's going on. Then on June 3rd, a real favorite of mine, Expecting Miracles to Work with Crosby & Farm, one of the great success stories of the year and or the last year, and we just can't wait to talk about it with you. So until next week, you're in our prayers. Don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.